Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Nibbanaṃ paramaṃ sukhaṃ ti. That's the old saying, Nibbana is the ultimate happiness and bliss. And it's only 10 days since I came out of my retreat. And sometimes those two-week retreats which you do, you've got so peaceful and so powerful, they supply you with enough material to give Dhamma talks usually for the next year. So it's very wonderful to be able to have those really oomphy meditations. And I think I was telling a few people when they asked, how was your retreat? And I said, it was a wonderful retreat, very peaceful, except for the suffering of coming out of retreat, which was always a lot of suffering. But that's just par for the course. Even though the external is suffering, you don't allow the mind to suffer. And just meditating this afternoon, just to see, just the idea of getting wise, getting insight, especially the insight which will make you a stream winner, an Aryan, get you really going on this amazing, deep, powerful path of the Buddha. It's one of the ways of seeing deeply into what dukkha truly is. As it says in the Noble Eightfold Path, sorry, I got that wrong, as it says in the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, that the noble truth of suffering, of dukkha, is to be known fully. It's, they say it's parinyaya. It's supposed to be known completely. Nyaya is knowing, and pari means like all around, completely, every aspect of it. And the Buddha said, until I knew it completely, totally, I could never be sure that I was fully enlightened. So our job is actually to understand, you know, the suffering, you know, in our existence, in all its aspects, to understand it fully. And just understanding it fully is usually enough to make you a stream winner. In the same way that when Mara comes in the wonderful both metaphor and real life in the suttas, all one needs to do is to know Mara fully. I know you, Mara. And then Mara has to sort of slink away. It's the knowing these things fully, understanding it completely, through wisdom which gives us the power to claim being Aryan, or to claim that we're on the path and we're going to get there very, very soon. It's the wisdom power which drives you, the knowledge, the understanding, the wisdom, the insight. So part of our job when we're meditating is not just to get into jhana. I'm biting my lip now because you know what I keep on saying about jhanas. I keep on saying that knowing that it's really important, but it's also to understand, you know, what is actually this suffering business. And usually in a talk like that, you just get rid of the ordinary suffering of life, in which you can understand that. You've been there and done that, hearing things you don't like to hear, people not treating you appropriately, the trouble of having so much business and people shouting and not doing the right thing, or getting tummy ache or getting knee ache, or being too hot or having hay fever, or being physically sick. You know, all that sort of suffering. I mean, so I'm not going to go and spend the hour talking about that. At least you should do by now. And you should know that that is something completely out of your control. There's no way that you can control this body and make it absolutely healthy. Even if you are on private health cover, you can still get a bad operation and get a dicky knee. Even if you do exercises, I still remember, actually one thing which shocked me as a young monk, because when I was, you know, in 20 or 21 or something, no, even earlier than that, I started doing yoga. The sort of thing which you do meditation, go to the Buddhist temples, do some yoga as well. And you used to be quite good at getting into all these postures. And what would really impress me was a program on TV, Yoga for Health. But mostly in the afternoons, you have to sort of tune in to see it and just practice with it. And from the United States, and I always remember this because the guy doing it, he's just this young, fit guy, and can get into all of these amazing postures. But one of the main reasons I watched it was because the girl, who was even more attractive, I was a young man, and she was amazing what posture she could get into. You know, but also watching her as well. But about 1 year after I became a monk, you know, somebody, I was talking to somebody who was visiting the monastery in Thailand, and I just happened to be talking about yoga. So I used to watch this program on TV, and there was, you know, a young, fit guy and girl, and the fellow, you know, it's from the United States, said, "You know what happened just a few months ago? The guy was on the set, and he dropped down dead." I said, "No, I can't do it. He did yoga. You don't die young when you do yoga." He said, "No, he died young." To me, that was quite a shock. Because at that time, I was stupid enough to think you could control your health. That you can, if you do yoga, eat brown rice, sort of, you know, live a stress-free lifestyle, give up fish and chips, and all that sort of stuff. Don't drink alcohol, don't do drugs. That you're going to live a long life. And there he was, the guy doing all of that. And he died young. And now that's actually quite a shock for me. Because that told me that there's something else. It's not just, you can't control this body of yours. Even if you do all the right things, you can still have a heart attack, get sick, get cancer, and all these rotten things can happen to you. So I know this physical body is out of my control. You look after it, you care for it as much as possible, but I'm not going to get upset when this body gets sick. It's not my fault. I'm not going to feel guilty about it and upset about it. Because sometimes people do feel guilty when they get sick. One time when I felt guilty when I got sick, it didn't hurt my back. I started sort of getting some very low energy states at one time in my monastic life. I remember going to be sitting in the doctor's surgery in Byford, sitting there waiting for my appointment. And that time I used to go teaching at Carnot Prison Farm. And one of the prison warders came in and recognized me. And what he said, he looked at me with actually quite disappointment. He said, "I never expected you to be in here." I felt as guilty as if he caught me in a pub or a brothel or something. You know, that monks weren't supposed to be in a doctor's surgery. And what he meant was, you know, I thought you guys were healthy, living a good lifestyle. I didn't expect you to be in a doctor's surgery. I started feeling guilty. You know, I wasn't meditating enough that I was in a doctor's surgery. But of course, you get over those stupid ideas that you can't control this bodily function. You just go with it, flow with it as best you can to ameliorate it, to lessen the problems, but you can't control it. That's the suffering of having a body. It's the suffering of birth. So eventually we all go to that stage that Judith is talking this morning. Just really hard times, sort of struggling to breathe, going really low energy states. Not really in physical pain, but the frustration of just not being able to do anything. And just to know that you're just on that slope down to a death in a day or two. That's what it's like, dying. And that's that type of suffering. But if you understand you're not in control of this body, at least you can just let it go and don't fight. I know many, many people, you know, being with them, you know, in those last hours when they're really struggling to breathe. I told her, just, it's going to be like that. It's just the body nature always wants to breathe. Don't fight it. There'll be that sort of that pain, that struggle of trying to breathe, and you can't do anything about that. You just go with it. It's just bodily stuff. So don't think I'm a Buddhist, I shouldn't be struggling. I'm just going to stop breathing now and die. You just can't do that. The body won't let you. So it's not you. It's just body doing its stuff. Now most of you should be able to know that stuff about the body. It's beyond your control. So what about other people's bodies and their behavior towards you, the way they speak to you, the way they act towards you? If you can't control your own body, how do you think you can control other people, what they speak or what they say? So the other part about suffering, we'll know that people will upset you. Or they won't upset you, they'll try to upset you. They will do things, you know, which, you know, they shouldn't do, so you think. Or they do things which are offensive, or say bad words, misunderstand you, accuse you, even hit you or push you. If you can't control your own body, how do you think you can control their bodies? Sometimes it's hard enough to control our own speech. So how can you control another person's speech? So as a meditator, as a Buddhist practitioner, after a while, we understand that this is to be expected. Praise and blame. Beautiful people and abusive people. Nice physical touches and harmful touches. People acting gracefully and people acting grossly. That's our life. That's what it's like to be a human being. It means we can't control it. We accept these things. We understand these things. That external suffering we should understand very quickly, because sometimes we waste so much time in monastic life just thinking about what someone said or did, just allowing it to obsess our mind for hours and hours, sometimes not being able to sleep at night thinking what someone said or did to you, which it's true was not appropriate. It was against the rules of Vinaya, it was against the rules of the monastery. Yeah, we know that. That's their karma. Your job is just to leave it alone, let it go. Don't allow other people's bad behavior to make you unhappy, or to obsess you, or to interfere with your own progress of meditation. Your job is just to move on, to let go. Now that's a practice which we should all be able to do as monks and nuns in this monastery. Not carry around the stupid speech and stupid actions of anybody else. When I first heard that idea, that was really weird. I always thought that when somebody misbehaved, it was your duty to tell them, or to tell someone to stop them misbehaving in the future. And all you did was to make matters worse. So when I was told that, no, you can just let it go, it's all right to leave it alone. And you had that beautiful story of Venerable Sariputta, when the man abused him all round the arms around, called him all sorts of names, and then he hit him on the back, and physically punched him. And what did Venerable Sariputta say afterwards? He was just completely at ease. And what happened? Oh, it was just sound, that's all. Sound arising, sound passing away. Wonderful if you could do that. They hit him, oh, it's just physical feeling, just vedana, painful vedana arising, painful vedana ceasing. That's all it is. Now that's sort of a great example. He never sort of turned around and punched the guy back, or gave as good as your back. You call me a pig. It's bad karma to call an arahat a pig. You'll get born as a pig in the next life. He never got into that sort of Western type stuff. He just noticed it, knew it, and let it go. He was one who knew Mara. The Mara of unpleasantness, unpleasant sense impressions. He could just let them go straight away. But once you can let go of that stuff, you know, the stuff that's going to obsess you, the external stuff, you've got more opportunity to actually to look much deeper to the underlying sufferings. It's the underlying sufferings which keep getting you reborn, not these external ones. These external, the gross types of sufferings which you have in life, you know, what in the suttas is called dukkha-dukkha, that type of suffering, the ordinary suffering of life, that has a function of stopping you from looking deeper. It's just a surface phenomena which can take up so much of your time, so much of your life, that you never dig any deeper. So that's why we have monastic institution with rules, with separation, with time by ourselves, so that we don't have to deal with so much of that dukkha-dukkha. Not as much as out there in that big bad world, which is far more sort of conflict, arguments, painful feelings than here in a nice soft monastery. So we do this so that that one can be just pushed aside. We can go deeper into the deeper sufferings of life. Which is why that we have a lot of solitude here. So in your hut, in your room, spending a lot of time by yourself, you actually face, and people say you have to face yourself. You're not facing yourself, you're facing your suffering. The inherent suffering of life. when we're so busy fixing up other people up, we're blind, we can't see this inherent suffering of existence. When we're busy making our fortune or building monasteries or building up the Buddhist society, we're just so busy we can very easily miss this inherent suffering. So what we have to do is to stop all of that from time to time, push it aside, and just sit alone with ourselves, not with external problems to fix, not worrying about what other people are doing. As Ajahn Chah always used to say, we look at other people at maximum only 5% of the time. We look at ourselves 95% of the time. In other words, 5% of the time, this is maximum. You should worry about what other people are doing. 95% of the time, you should be concerned what you're doing, how you're reacting, how you're speaking, how you're walking, how you're doing. Other people, that's their business. 95% of the time, at least, minimum, you should be mindful of your own speech, actions, and also what's happening in your mind. When we do things like that, we start to get into the internal practice of understanding the suffering of just being. When we're actually in our huts, especially in a range retreat period or in meditation time, sometimes you get bored. So what is actually boredom? So we investigate that. We just, instead of running away from these things, we just sit there with it. When you sit and spend time with things, you get to know them. Yeah, it's unpleasant because we always want to run away from that which is painful and hard to endure. But we just sit there with it and understand what is boredom. Why? And part of our meditative practice should always be this investigating, by which I don't mean thinking, that's not investigating, staying with something silent with this inquisitive mind, just to explore it, to experience it, to be in it. For example, those of you when you first came to Bodhinyana Monastery, how did you understand and experience Bodhinyana Monastery? You can't think about it. You're here, you'll stay here, you understand it by just the experience of being in this monastery for such a time. And that's actually how you investigate, how you understand phenomena. You stay with it long enough. You don't need to do anything. You don't need to sort of go and think, what does it mean? You just need to experience it, allow it to soak into you until you understand it just by persistent experience of the object. The mind gets annoyed by itself. The thought actually separates your understanding from the object by thinking, oh, that's what it is. By giving it a label, giving it a description, and not allowing your mind to go deeper. So if you stay bored, you stay with that boredom. Understand it. Feel it. Don't think about it. And after a while, you understand what that truly is. The only suffering which is there, well, not the only suffering, but the main suffering, which is with the boredom, is just wanting to be somewhere else. You don't like this feeling. It's, you know, you think you should have something better. You know, you want sort of that feeling of peace and joy, and which you had sort of the last meditation. There's always wanting something else. The old craving is a cause of suffering business. Wanting stops you being where you are. Whenever you want something, there's that old, as it says in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, when you want something, there's a separation from what you desire, what you want. Being separated from what you want, associated with what you don't want, is suffering. Just as the Buddha said. So whenever there's that boredom there, you want something else, this is what you have, you don't like it, that's called suffering. So you can understand the suffering of boredom. But the great thing is that when you do the insight practice, the samatha practice, doesn't matter what you call it, it is all the same. You stay with this to experience it. That's called samatha. You're at peace. You don't move. You don't run away. You're strong. You're courageous. The courageous effort, the hero effort, the virya, from viro, hero, and virya is energy. So you stand your ground. In unpleasant situations, you stand your ground, not just to be the tough guy or the tough nun. You stand your ground so you can gain more experience. As it says in the Chinese art of war, know yourself, know your enemy, 1,000 battles fought, 1,000 battles won. And they're not talking about soldiers fighting soldiers. This is talking about the battle of meditation. We don't actually fight. We just need to know ourselves, know what the so-called hindrances are, and know what boredom is, know what restlessness is, know what doubt is, by not trying to get rid of it, but staying there, making peace with it, being kind to it, accepting it. As Ajahn Chah kept on telling us, a mosquito is irritating, that's why it's called Ajahn Mosquito. It's your teaching you. You get sick, that's a great Dharma talk you're experiencing, the sickness of your own body. You're in pain, what a great sermon that is. You're understanding not just the physical feeling of pain, but how your mind deals with it and reacts to it and cringes against it and wants to get out of it and hopes and fantasizes. This is how you learn. This is why it's teachers. This is why to be able to understand the Dharma teaching, we have to sit there and take it all in, even though it's unpleasant. To absorb moment after moment after moment without moving away from the great teachers of life. So if it's boredom, we sit with it. We don't move. We don't get up and go and do something else. I'm bored. I'll go and read a book. I'm bored. I'll go for a walk. I'm bored. I'll go and have a cup of tea. Sit with it. Be with it. Absorb it. Not only do you understand boredom, I'm just using boredom as one example, but you find boredom vanishes. This is an amazing thing. Once you get to know it, I know you, Mara, Mara disappears. So you sit with boredom. What is this? You don't move. You absorb. You're one with it. And that's where you find out that with that stillness, you are creating the karmic causes for that negative state to disappear. You understand, where did the boredom come from? What's its cause? What's its origin? How does it disappear? Straight as the Buddha taught in the suttas. We don't just try and get rid of these things, we want to find out where is this thing from. And you understand not by thinking again, you understand by experiencing. The boredom disappears. Why? And you find that the boredom is just old karma. From wanting something else, you generated too much craving. When you generate craving, it always leads to that disappointment. It's not what you want. You want something else. You've got these great ideas of the pure land of meditation, or of the jhana realms, or enlightenment realms. And you're sort of aspiring for that. You are, as Ajahn Chah famously said, searching for the tortoise with the moustache. What you think is jhanas is not the real thing. What was it? Yang yang manyati tang tang anyata. It's probably erroneous, but it's something like that in the Saporissa Sutta. Whatever you imagine it will be, it's actually different than that. So, for those of you who never achieved jhanas yet, what you're actually aiming for is not the jhanas. You're actually pointing the mind in the wrong direction. That's why it's so hard for people to get jhanas, because they just don't know where they're going. They don't know where to aim. They think they do, and that is a delusion. Even you get nimittas, you haven't got nimitta yet. You know, you don't know what you're doing, and so you aim for the wrong things. You aim for the nimitta, rather than the cause of the nimitta, which is stillness, which is peace, which is doing nothing, which is rest, relaxation, loving kindness, letting go, the absence of will, not the increase of will. If we can only understand that, just the path of meditation becomes so clear at last. When you have breakthroughs, it's as if you want to hit your head with your fist and say, stupid, 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 how could I miss this for so many years? so many years you've heard his great teachers, the Ajahn Chahs, telling you. The Buddha is actually shouting it in the suttas. But you can study those suttas and know Pali backwards and you still don't get it. So there's these wonderful times of insight when you experience, you know, like the nimitta stage or the jhana stage, and you know exactly what it is and where it comes from. Does not come from wanting things, from aspiring. That's why you can start just with boredom and just let the boredom be. I love you, boredom. You can be with me for the rest of your life. And then the boredom vanishes, nimittas come out, the whole works happens. Why? Because you have let go of craving. You've let go of the self, which does all the craving. You actually see Mara. Mara's not outside. Mara is you. Yourself, this doer business. Which is why that they put Mara in the realm of the head of the paranimitta Vasavati realm. Vasavati wielding control. Paranimitta over others' creations. This is what wields power over you. You can see that Mara inside of you. That is Mr. and Mrs. Dua. When you actually notice that, you know, that's the Mara. If I keep feeding Mara and indulging my Dua, my will, my wanting, how the heck will I ever get anywhere close to Nibbana? No way. That was my problem. That's why it never worked. So instead of that, you get bored. Stay with boredom. Don't even move. You can be still with boredom. You're restless, thinking so many things. What is restlessness again? Restlessness is old karma. As I said a couple of months ago, it's because your mind has been working, agitated, doing things, thinking things. Sometimes you have to do that. Maybe your duties, if you're in the office as a secretary, or you're me, or you're helping Ajahn Kampong, you have to do things. As a result of that activity, you can expect some restlessness of mind afterwards, because that's, you've just agitated the water. It's going to have ripples, it's going to have waves. There'll be a time before they settle down. This is old karma. So you sit down there, you've been busy, you can have lots of old karmic restlessness coming up. And I know this, sometimes I'm really surprised just how I can do so much and then meditate so deeply. And the reason is, yeah, when I sit down, I'll be going to, where was it last night, to Buddhist Council, or having teleconferences for the Australian Sangha Association, or doing this and doing that. I know that will create some restlessness. If I go and sit down afterwards, I will have lots of restlessness or tiredness sometimes. But I know that's old karma. I can see very clearly where that's come from. My brain is tired or it's agitated. I know exactly what it is. I know I'm not going to make any new bad meditation karma by fighting that. Instead, I make peace, kind, gentle, leave it alone. I just embrace and know this. Whatever moment it is, tiredness, because you've been out driving, working, cooking the meal, doing the breakfast, cleaning the toilets. You know where the restlessness or tiredness comes from. It's nature. You cannot fight nature. You can't control your body. You know you can't control your mind. All you can do is create causes. You're bored. You're tired, you're restless. That is old karma. You have to accept that. It's law of nature. What you can do is to make sure you don't make any new unwholesome karma. Especially no new unwholesome meditation karma. No striving. No ill will. No guilt. No forcing, no control, no ego driving the process. You just step out of the way. As you're stepping out of the way, you're learning what these things are. You're embracing. As the Buddha said, you're beginning to know dukkha thoroughly. You know restlessness thoroughly. You know boredom thoroughly. Doubt thoroughly. Tiredness thoroughly. These are parts which we have to know. And what do we know? They don't belong to us. They're not some personal fault. They're caused. You can see how they're caused, not by thinking, why, where did it come from? Just by watching the whole process. As you watch the whole process, you just see the causes, you see it happening, you see development and how these things grow and how they fade away again. You get to know, not by thinking, but by observing, by feeling, by knowing, by being there. So as you do this, you understand it's worthwhile doing nothing, because this is where we learn. And it's also where these things fade away. As you do the inside of learning, if you do it properly, by being still, by embracing, by accepting, looking at these things as ajahns for yourself, they disappear. The insight and the calming occur simultaneously. By leaving things alone, that's how we learn from them. By leaving things alone, that's how they settle down. There are no problems anymore. We just watch the boredom. We're with it, we'll be with it. Saying, boredom, teach me. So old karma, the good karma is being still, being peaceful, being kind, being interested in the sense of inquisitive, but not with thinking. Just understanding, the longer you stay with this, the more you learn from it. Stay with it, learn from it, be with it. You get to know it. As you get to know it, it fades. The old karma wears out. And the beautiful new karma, the new karma of just wanting to know, dhammavicaya, mindfulness, the heroic effort of just staying with things rather than trying to get rid of them, brings the beautiful joy and peace. The whole, what is it, the 7 enlightenment factors. I never intended to talk about that, Dhamma just comes. The 7 enlightenment factors, you can see how they're developed there. Because as you just know these things, you become still. As you become still, the restlessness still is rolling along. That's what Ajahn Chah meant by, still waters flowing. You're still inside. Because you're still inside, the waters still flow. But because you're still inside, the flowing water is the old karma. The stillness is you making the beautiful new karma. And if you're still watching the flowing waters start to stop. They ebb and flow less. They settle down. They become calm. Because you're not agitating anything anymore. You are the creator. The ego, the self, the doer. That's what causes these things. And the more there is a doer, a creator, a me, a great ego inside, or a small ego even, the more you'll be sort of creating this world, making it, and what we only create is only suffering. When we do things, we create problems. For ourselves especially, and sometimes, quite frequently actually for others. When you're still, you don't create problems for anybody, especially yourself. So we learn just how to be with these states of mind. Being with them, we're learning, understanding them. Which is why that when people say, I can't meditate. Come off it, you're missing the point. I was restless. Wonderful teacher, Ajahn Restlessness. Stay with it. Learn from it. I was just so slothful and torpid. I just was so dull. I got up this morning. Great. What a wonderful teacher that is for you. Just stay with the sloth and torpor. Learn from it. But it's unpleasant. Of course it is. We're learning about dukkha. If you want to become enlightened, you've got to learn from dukkha. Have the heroic effort. The hero can just stand its ground, even though it's unpleasant, even though it's really painful sometimes. Stand our ground. Great things happen. You understand suffering? It also disappears at the same time. And that becomes really neat. You're watching the restless mind. You say, I'm not going to fight you anymore. I'm not going to keep bringing my mind back to the breath and stopping you, stupid mind. Come on. Grabbing hold of your mind, screwing it up and putting it on the object. And if you move one inch, I'm going to kick your ass, mind. Yeah, I've done that before, you've done that before, and it's just not a man thing. Women do it as well. Gays as well, probably, I don't know. That type of mind state, just, you can play around with that for a while, but it doesn't lead you anywhere. But you get this heroic effort. I'm not going to fight you, I'm going to be with you. Come on. And when you actually say, come on tomorrow, come on. Come on, bring it on, Mara. Mara just slinks away. The monk knows me again. Oh, gee. Waste of fun. Waste of time just messing around with these Bodhinyana monks or Dharmasara nuns and go somewhere else. So if you understand what to do, you can always meditate. It doesn't matter if you're restless, in pain. It doesn't matter if you're tired. It doesn't matter if you're sort of sitting there nodding your head off until it almost falls off and hits the floor. It depends on your attitude. Meditation has nothing to do with what you're experiencing. Everything to do with how you're experiencing it. It's the attitude, not the thing. If you know that, you know what good meditation karma is, as I mentioned before. You know you can meditate any time with anything. And you don't have to say, oh, it was a bad meditation because I didn't get jhana this time, I was just sloppy, I was thinking. That's what are you talking about? You're measuring the wrong thing. What you should be looking at is how you reacted to that. What you did with that mind state, with the tiredness, with the restlessness. Tiredness, restlessness, whatever it is old karma, remember. You can't change old karma. It's done. It's nature. What you can do is work with this moment making good karma. Remember the right intention? Letting it go. Nekama. Sankapa. Avayapada Sankapa, which is kindness. The door of my heart's open to this restlessness. And with Ahimsaka. Non-violence. Gentleness. That's making good karma. That's samasankapa. That's right intention. Intention is karma. Chedana han karma wadami, said the Buddha. I say that karma is chedana, is sankapa, is will, is intention. Understand that. You know how to make this beautiful, good karma. And you also understand at the same time. So you understand what this inherent boredom of life is. What it actually is, even deeper than that, is just senses. Having any sort of sensory experience at all is just unsatisfactory. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, especially physical feeling. And after a while, you see there's no happiness to be found there. Not at all in any which way. It's a brilliant sort of thing to understand. If all of you are just putting your hopes and dreaming of the wonderful meal you're going to have with your family when you leave here at Christmas time or when they invite you back to your home, look, it just, you know that it's in your mouth and it's gone. So it's nowhere near as nice as you imagine. Any of you are thinking sexual fantasies? Most of you have had sex before, and you know it's not the same as how you fantasize. It's just over and gone in just a few minutes, if you're lucky. And so the fantasies are just not the real thing. when you find the perfect girl or the perfect boy, no such animal exists. Just sit next to me, sort of, and just see all these women tell about the perfect boy they married who's not perfect anymore. And that beautiful woman who's now old and ugly and smelly. Come on, get real. And so that those fantasy realms, we make them up, they're not real. Why do we make up those fantasies anyway? Why do we want to read so many books? Or why do we want to go for the walks? Why do we want to do these things anyway? Why do we want to dream about the great meal we're going to have? That's what really interested me. It was not that fantasy, but why do you want to fantasize? Not because you're thinking about the next beautiful meal, but why do you want to do that anyway? And sometimes you're all smart enough, know what I said is absolutely true, but nevertheless, I'm going to do it anyway. There's that famous, famous quote from Venerable Vimala, now Ajahn Vimala in England, once said. It's a classic, and it was funny, but it was also very true of an ordinary person. An ordinary monk, please excuse me, ladies, young monk seeing a beautiful girl come into the monastery. Yeah, it's just 32 parts of the body, just hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. It's not me, not mine, not a self, full of suffering, it won't last, but she's good enough. That's actually how it works. Why is it good enough? We know it's not really good enough. It's good enough to get out of this sense of boredom with these five khandhas or with these senses. I've got to see things and I've got to feel things in the body and I've got to smell, I've got to taste. And it's because we don't understand this, we just run away, try to find some happiness where it will never be found. That's a chasing after the tortoise with a moustache. That's a mangy dog in that simile. It's from the suttas, but Ajahn Chah used to use it. Mangy dog, always thinking the itch will go away once you change the circumstances. That's why you get the itch of a young novice wants to disrobe. Yeah, you've got itchiness, but you go and disrobe. The itchiness doesn't go away. And then go and disrobe, and okay, I'm not going to sort of stay in Australia, go to Singapore. You still get the itch in Singapore. Well, maybe I'll change religion and become a Christian. You still get the itch. It's, just running away. So the wonderful thing about being a spiritual warrior, if you want to do that, but not a violent one, you're still, the heroic effort of just staying still and saying, I'm going to be with this. I'm not going to go off to fantasy. I'm not going to go and read a book. I'm not going to make myself a cup of tea. It's unpleasant. Yeah, I know. But I'm going to stick with it. I'm going to know suffering. There's just the suffering of having five senses and a body. To stay with it. And understand just where this restlessness, the pain which causes restlessness, where it comes from, how it feels. So you stay in that place just before the restlessness begins. You stay in that place just before the negativity to boredom arises. You stay in that place of being not having happiness before anger comes up. What does it feel like? Someone has just called you a stupid pig. Before you get angry, what does it feel having received that sound? You stay with those unpleasant vedanas caused by the senses. You stay with them. You don't react because you want to understand these things. To understand that trigger which usually would give rise to the negative states of boredom, guilt, anger, fear, restlessness, fantasies, lust, all that sort of stuff. Where does that come from? It's just our way of dealing with those painful states because we don't understand, we don't know them, we don't know any other escape. So if you want to become enlightened, you have to stay with those painful experiences to know them. Know them, they're all karma. And by making this new old bad, new, sorry, this old bad, result of old bad karma, these painful states, they're the results of old bad karma, and if you make new bad karma with them, you're going to get more of this stuff later on in your life, later on in the day usually. So when you have these unpleasant feelings, make good karma. Stay with it. Be kind. Be still. Let go. Be gentle. If you can do that, you know that those sources, causes, triggers of restlessness, fantasies, anger, ill will, guilt, negativity, the causes are being dealt with. Which means in future you just don't get bored. You just don't get angry. You don't want fantasies. They're not necessary anymore for you. Because you've dealt with the causes. This unpleasant feeling, this yuckiness, this, I can't stand this. Stay with this, I can't stand this. Stick with it. You understand it, you learn from it, and thankfully it just doesn't last very long when you stay with it. Making good karma works very fast. It's a great snake oil. It works almost immediately. When you don't fight these things, you just stay with them, Mara slinks away pretty quickly. So this feeling of, I don't like this, I'm bored, stay with it. When you make peace with it, it just changes. That's the old simile I gave a long time ago, the thousand petal lotus. Most enlightenment lotus, which has got beautiful enlightenment inside of it, beautiful jhana, inner petals. When it's all closed, it looks so dirty, gross, filthy, so coarse, these lotuses, when they're closed up at night. Because those outermost petals have to take all the wind and the dust, and they're coarse. And sometimes you can't believe that, inside that closed lotus bud, closed up, on the outside it looks just so absolutely unpromising, dirty, filthy, coarse, rough, nothing beautiful or refined or super mundane can live inside of such a coarse outer covering. But you find it does. You got this pain, this existential angst, this unsatisfactory feeling of just being. But instead of going off into fantasies, anger, restlessness, or boredom, you stay with that. You stay with it, maybe for the purpose of understanding it, maybe for the purpose of making good karma with this state. And gee, what happens is unexpected. Once you know about it, you know it's going to happen. You just stay with it, not expecting anything. And the lotus opens. This rotten old state, which would normally give rise to, let's have a fantasy, let's go for a walk, let's have a cup of tea. This rotten old state, which usually triggers those more activity, you stay with it, and it blossoms. It opens out. And these rotten old states of existential anguish, despair even. That's beautiful lotuses. If you get the despairing experiences, stick with that one. Wow, that can really open up into beautiful lotuses. That's why some people at the end of their tether can get these enlightened experiences. They've had enough. Because incredibly harsh experience. But they stick with it. Somehow because they've got no choice. Have to stick with it. When you stick with it, don't fantasize, don't get angry, don't sort of do anything with it, stick with it. It's the sun maintaining its warmth on the outermost petals of the lotus. It doesn't take that long when the sun's up for that warmth to open the outermost leaves. And amidst that unbearable boredom, amidst that really unpromising and hopeless anguish of existence. And that's the physical pain or the mental just I've had enoughness. Inside that opens out peace, stillness, even bliss. Now how many times that's happened in my monastic life? because I know exactly what to do. Any blockage on the path, any barrier to your meditation, any huge wall which comes up in front of you in your path to liberation, never do you attack that wall. Just stand there and do absolutely nothing, saying, "Thank you, wall, for being here. I just want to understand you and learn from you." And that wall just vanishes. It just melts. It disintegrates. Just with the power of the good karma of Samasankhapa, of letting it be kindness and gentleness. And those are great experiences to have. Because you've got this absolutely hopeless state of mind. And it just disintegrates in front of your mental eye. It vanishes. And then you get, wow, you're really away then. Away into these deep meditations. You get all the pity sukha and the calmness. And wow, you have a wonderful old time. That's why I want to share these things with you. I want you to bliss out as well. Not just bliss out for the sake of blissing out. Well, it may be okay, that's why not. But because of why it works. To understand, just understand suffering. Be with it. Don't get rid of it. And then you understand how it goes away. The cause of suffering was all this wanting it to go away, instead of wanting to be with it. That's why the simile which I gave last week, walking up and down sort of the lake, or not the, walking up and down the shore of the river, sorry. You're walking up and down the shore of the river, trying to find a way across. You walk up, you walk down, looking for a bridge, looking for a ferry, anything, or a tunnel to get across. Walk up, walk down, and the way across is perpendicular. You can step over that lake or that river. It's not that wide. But actually, the way you cross it, you just stay still. And you stop all your wanting. And the less you want, the more narrow that river becomes. When you really want to cross it, it's wide, wider than an ocean. The more you want to get to Nibbana, the more impossible it becomes. But the more you just let go of all wanting, all craving, the more you just still. So instead of trying to cross, you try, what is it like being on this bank? What's it like suffering? Be right in the middle of that suffering. Don't move away from the lotus. When you stop trying to cross, the river gets narrower and narrower. It's the other bank comes to you. You don't do the crossing. The other bank comes closer and closer until there is no river anymore to cross. You are on the other bank. That's how it works. That's what it's like. That's the metaphor which describes experience. Okay, it may sound very Zen-like, but there's no, I'm not doing these things out of being some sort of smart-aleck Zen teacher. I'm just describing experience. When you stop trying to cross, just the river separating you from Nibbana gets less and less until it's a trickle, until it's nothing there. The other bank comes to you when you stop, when you don't strive, when you're kind, when you're gentle, when you let things be. Now that takes effort. That takes heroism. Because you have to completely undermine what your sense of self wants to do. You want to control this whole process. Just like you want to control your body. Just like you want to control other people in the monastery. Just like you want to control everything. Maybe not everything, but there's a lot of things you want to sort of get your finger in and work out and make better. You find every time you get involved in trying to make things better, you usually make things worse. Leave them alone. Especially meditation. When you're sitting down there on your mat in your hut, feeling that I've had enough. Stop. Just be there. What do you mean, had enough? What does that feel like? What do I mean? had enough. Stay with that experience of suffering. You'll also understand why that suffering gets worse, because you want to get rid of it. You add more bad karma to this moment, so you're going to get more bad results later on. The law of karma by the Buddha is absolutely brilliant. Just, you can see what's going on. This moment is karma vipaka, the result of old karma. Can't do anything with this moment. You can't change this moment. It's here, for goodness sake. And all this wanting to change things in the future, this future business, you know that that is going to cause trouble. Wanting something in the future, having future perceptions, wow, you're asking for trouble. So you just stay in this moment where craving for the future can't come. You're just with whatever you're experiencing. Understanding it, learning from it. By just being with it again and again and again, moment to moment to moment, not wanting to go anywhere else. It's also, the whole thing disappears. You understand what is the path to the deep meditations. It's not just the path of deep meditations, this is the path to Nibbana as well. It's the same path. You take it a short distance that leads to jhanas. You keep following that path, it leads to enlightenment. It's the same path. So jhanas are just landmarks on the path to Nibbana. It's just what happens when you let go. Which is why there are stages of letting go, not stages of attachment. You can't attach the jhanas, they're too ephemeral, they're just too nothing. It's just like trying to grasp the air, or just hang on to the air. You can't attach, you can't put your fist up into the air and drag yourself up. No more than you can attach to the jhanas, there's hardly anything there. It's like the air, like the atmosphere. You need a mountain or a sort of a tree to climb up, something solid. The air, you just can't hold it, you can't grab onto it, you can't pull yourself up from it. That's what it's like with jhanas, you just can't attach them, you can't grab them. Because there's hardly anything left. They're great states of nothingness. Not total nothing, but they're pretty close to absolute 100% emptiness. So that's why you can't attach them. The things, what happens when things disappear, they fade away. Just to get to the center of the lotus, you have to get to the petals on, in between. You just can't just suddenly get to the center of the lotus. You have to go through every petal. Every petal has to open in sequence. So the jhanas have to be there. But don't aim for the jhanas. Don't aim for enlightenment. Aim for stillness. Or rather, still the aiming. Still everything. Just be here. And even if it's boredom, restlessness, even if it's anger, really upset. What does it feel like to be upset? Stay with it. Say, look, this is suffering. I have to learn from this. Not try and get rid of it. Not feel guilty about it. Not blame someone else for causing it. You're never going to get anywhere that way. Stay with it. Be with your anger. To really understand it, what it's like. Not thinking about it, but experiencing it minute after minute after minute after minute. You do that. Wow, Mara, he's dead. He's gone. You find that you understand the feeling. You find you're making good karma. The anger turns to bliss. And sometimes you go up to that person and say, thank you so much for being a complete pain in the neck, a complete idiot. Thank you for making me angry so much and making me enlightened. Maybe that's going a bit far. It won't go that far, but at least you learn so much. So this is actually how we practice the insight and the calm. I can't see how they differ. It's just, when you practice insight, you get calm. When you're calm, you get insight. It's just exactly the same path. It's not even two sides of the same hand. I can't even separate them that far. They're just too close together. As you practice, as you learn, and you find The path is not hard. Meditation is easy. Enlightenment is a doddle. Just once you know how to do it, or rather how not to do it. So talks like this, you have to keep on pushing and pushing, and now you probably all know how to become enlightened and how to get jhanas and think, wow, it makes so much sense now. And then you go back to your huts and start trying again and trying to get jhanas and try to get enlightened. But stop it. Just be with what you have. Be still. My favorite word for this range retreat. Stillness. And not stilling what's out there, because you can't do that. No way as an abbot can I control you guys. I cannot be Adolf Brahm, the Führer of Bodhinyana Monastery. Instead, just teach, lead, let go. Well, you can do things like that. Teach, lead, and I'm trying to think of an acronym, my TLC. Teach, let go, and I don't know what else. Oh, a cup of tea. Let's see. And that way you just let people go, let this moment go. And leave it alone. Let it go. It's so easy to meditate. So don't try this practice. Understand it. So you can get the message. Sometimes you're always teaching Dharma from the left, from the right, from up, from down, always pointing at the same direction. The ability to be still. When things are moving outside, the restlessness, nimittas moving backwards and forwards, but this thing which is doing the watching is absolutely still. You calm the doer. Not what's out there, but what's inside. What's doing the watching? That's what you have to calm down. Make still. Bring peace to. Once this doer, which is the creator, becomes still, of course the created becomes still too. But you have to do it first. It has to be from inside out, not from outside in. You try and calm the world. The thing inside is still not still. Still moves. It comes from inside out, not outside in. You get the most beautiful, peaceful monastery. You can have just the most wonderful huts and food and perfect, but that's only the outside becomes calm and satisfactory. It's not outside in, it's inside out. The inside, you know what I'm talking about? What, the yoni thing inside of you? The one doing the watching, the one doing the doing, where it's all coming from inside of you. Going deep, what's actually hearing me right now? That's what I'm talking about. That has to be stilled. When it comes from the inside and that inside becomes still, anything on the outside becomes still. Inside out meditation. So you still it inside. When this one watching becomes really still, whether you're watching the breath, doesn't matter, nimittas, they just come. Because the whole path of watching the breath, the full awareness of the breath, beautiful breath, nimittas, stabilizing nimittas, the jhanas, the first jhana, the second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, immaterial states. All these are just what happens when inside becomes still. When the inside becomes still, then the outside becomes still afterwards. Just like when you put down a glass of water, you put it down first of all. And then the water becomes still. You can't make the water still first of all, and then you become still. The one doing the holding, the one doing the grasping, the one doing the interfering, that one, deep inside, needs to be stilled. If you get that point, yeah, you just, meditation becomes just so easy. This is the one inside which needs to be still. You can see that, you get that point, you can understand it, you get to know that thing inside. It's so hard to get words for this, but you think you understand. hopefully, eventually, after maybe another 10 years, and then you still that one up, and all the other things happen quite naturally. The longer you keep still, the deeper you go. No fear, no excitement, no controlling, no anything. You're just a passenger, watching all these amazing things happen. Understanding suffering, and now you're understanding suffering fading away. Understand all that suffering of the world is because you're trying to want to get rid of it. You thought there was some sort of state of happiness which you could reach if you put enough effort, if you were smart enough, devious enough, cunning enough. If you work really hard and learn everything and become cunning and clever, then you can get out of suffering. No, it don't work that way. The more cunning, the more active, the more work, the more you struggle, the more you go deeper into the pit of shit. When you start to let go, be still. Wow. You emerge from the pit of shit, or the shit pit, sounds better. You emerge from the shit pit of samsara. You rise into the fragrant jhana pit. And then you just go through the jhana pit into nibbana. Because you're still, you stop, you cease. So does all suffering, and so do you, and so do me, because I'm finishing now. End of talk.
Very good.
Sūpaṭipanno bhagavato